Welcome to the debate.
Thank you.
So imagine building your entire identity, right? Your community standing and your spiritual future on one single promise. And that promise is the traditional family.
Right.
You follow the rules, you honor the scripts, and you build a life inside a very, very specific architecture.
Mm-hmm.
Now imagine waking up in your mid-40s and watching that entire structure just evaporate.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Because the collapse of modern marriage, I mean, it isn't just a logistical failure for those going through it. For midlife singles coming out of strict Latter-day Saint or, you know, similar conservative faith backgrounds, it is a devastating double crisis.
It really is.
When their marriages fail, or honestly, when they fail to materialize in the first place, they don't just lose a partner. They face this sudden, terrifying identity crisis.
Right, because they're stripped of everything?
Exactly. They are stripped of the cultural markers that defined their worth. And that's compounded by a profound spiritual crisis over these broken theological promises regarding family and fulfillment. I mean, the exile is absolute.
It is. The void they are left navigating is, well, it's truly difficult to overstate.
Yeah.
You're talking about individuals who have built their entire cosmological reality on this foundation.
Mm-hmm.
When it fractures, there is just no map for what comes next.
Right.
Like the culture provides no secular safety net that can replace a lost eternal promise.
Which I think forces us to ask the uncomfortable question driving our discourse today. Like, why is the institution of marriage and dating collapsing so spectacularly that it leaves these individuals stranded in this double crisis?
Right.
The cultural rot is undeniable at this point, but the root cause is highly contested.
Oh, absolutely.
So to understand what is happening to these relationship structures, we are looking at three specific video essays that attempt to diagnose the current landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And those are Max Fisher's video, The Real Reason Dating is Broken, Kite Willett's video, The Responsibilities of Women That Men Never Receive, and Kite Willett's video, Divorce, Why the System is Failing Men.
Those specific videos are vital here, I think, because they refuse to settle for the, you know, the superficial explanations we are usually handed.
Right, like the lazy tropes.
Exactly. The tropes about why people can't seem to stay together or even find each other anymore. They dig way past the standard narratives of people are just selfish now or social media ruined everything.
And it's so much deeper than that. And I look at the arguments presented in these videos, particularly through the lens of modern economics. And to me, it becomes clear that this crisis is fundamentally structural.
Okay.
The collapse we are witnessing is a rational market response to an outdated romantic bargain.
Interesting.
If we draw on Max Fisher's video, The Real Reason Dating is Broken, we have to examine the history of the traditional marriage bargain.
Right.
For generations, this was a highly defined, albeit very unequal exchange. Women traded domestic labor and childrearing for financial security and social acceptance.
That was the deal.
That was the deal. And in strict faith communities like the LDS Church, this exchange was elevated from a mere survival tactic to divine law. But, you know, the secular world has moved on. Women have achieved financial independence. They can earn their own security now.
Right.
Yet the expectation for them to perform a second shift of household labor remains incredibly rigid. So women are looking at a deal that literally doubles their workload and rationally opting out.
See, you're pointing to the spreadsheet of the household, which I get.
Yeah.
But reducing marriage, especially the covenantal marriage idealized in strict faith backgrounds, to a mere economic transaction completely ignores the psychological machinery that is actually tearing it apart.
Okay, explain that.
Well, drawing on Kate Willard's video, Divorce, Why the System is Failing Men, and her video, The Responsibilities of Women That Men Never Receive, a very different driver emerges.
Right.
We are looking at the results of a 40-year cultural project. And this project has meticulously defined male obligations in a relationship, while entirely erasing female obligations.
Erasing them entirely?
Entirely. And into this vacuum of accountability, women have been handed a weaponized clinical vocabulary. It allows them to reframe ordinary marital dissatisfaction as clinical harm.
Ah.
So this gives them a morally unassailable exit from the relationship, which shields them from the cultural and spiritual shame of divorce while utterly devastating the men who are left behind.
I mean, I struggle with the idea that women are simply weaponizing a vocabulary to escape perfectly functional marriages.
Well,
I just, if we are going to talk about who is exiting these relationships and why, we really need to look closely at the data on initiation.
Then let's look at it. Let's look at Michael Rosenfield's 2017 Stanford study, which was heavily cited in Kite Willett's video, Divorce: Why the System is Failing Men.
Right, the Stanford study.
Yes. This study is the hinge upon which this entire discussion turns, honestly. Rosenfeld's data reveals a glaring statistic. Women initiate 69% of divorces.
69%? That's a huge number.
It is. Now, the default cultural narrative, right, the one we have all been spoon-fed to explain this, is that women file because men are simply bad partners.
Right, that they're dropping the ball at home.
Exactly. The story goes that men are lazy, they don't do the dishes, they check out emotionally, and women just finally get fed up.
Right.
But Rosenfeld's study didn't just look at marriages. He looked at non-marital heterosexual couples as well, so dating and cohabitating couples.
Mm-hmm.
And crucially, that 69% asymmetry does not exist in those relationships. Men and women dissolve dating and cohabitating relationships at roughly equal rates.
Let's pause there, because what you were suggesting is that the male behavior isn't the variable driving the breakups.
Exactly.
You were saying the gap only appears when the formal legal structure of marriage is involved.
Yes. If men were inherently worse partners, or if they were universally failing at this second shift of domestic labor you mentioned, that lopsided breakup rate would show up across all relationship types.
Sure.
A lazy boyfriend is just as annoying as a lazy husband.
True.
But because the asymmetry only appears in legal marriage, it proves the issue is not fundamentally about male behavior. It is about how the human psyche handles the heavy, locked-in, legal and cultural structure of marriage.
I see.
Cost you your eternal family? The psyche utilizes what the psychologist Alfred Adler called safeguarding tendencies.
Safeguarding tendencies.
Right. The human brain reaches for a narrative that licenses the exit without costing the person their social standing. They can't just say, I'm bored, or I want to see other people, because the community would turn on them.
Especially an LDS community.
Exactly. So the psyche manufactures a crisis of harm to justify the exit.
Okay, I see the logic in Adler's safeguarding theory, but let me give you a different perspective, because I think you were skipping over the fundamental math of the household.
Okay, let's hear the math.
Think about a corporate merger.
All right.
If you and I start a casual joint venture, which is essentially what dating or even cohabitating is, we keep our own separate profit and loss statements. We collaborate, but our liabilities aren't fully entangled.
Right, we can walk away.
Exactly. If the venture stops being fun or profitable, either one of us can easily walk away. You don't see massive legal dissolution asymmetries in casual joint ventures.
Right.
But marriage is the merger. It is the point where the structural inequality becomes a binding, inescapable burden. The party that initiates the break in a merger is almost always the one realizing they are carrying the entire operational load without receiving the promised equity.
But you are assuming the operational load is actually unbalanced in a way that justifies the destruction of the family unit?
The data says it is.
Does it?
It absolutely does. Max Fisher's video highlights a brilliant economic paper called Winning the Bread and Baking It Too.
Oh, I'm familiar with that one.
The findings there are so damning for the modern marital structure. It shows that even when wives earn twice as much as their husbands, like when they are unequivocally the primary breadwinners,
right,
they still do double the housework.
Hmm.
So the asymmetry in marriage dissolution isn't some subconscious psychological trick where a woman is trying to protect her social standing. It is the breaking point of structural exhaustion.
Exhaustion?
Yes. Dating doesn't replicate that exhaustion because you haven't legally bound your labor and your finances to someone who, frankly, creates more daily work for you than they alleviate.
Okay, but
marriage is the only institution where that specific labor trap snaps shut, which perfectly explains why women are the ones pulling the ripcord 69% of the time.
Okay, but framing the collapse of a sacred covenant solely around who loads the dishwasher or manages the household logistics is exactly the kind of transactional thinking that is killing the institution in the first place.
I don't think it's just about the dishwasher. It's about time and energy.
Yes. Formal marriage is a unique pressure cooker, and merging lives is difficult. But what happens inside that pressure cooker is governed by the vocabulary we use to describe our friction.
The vocabulary.
Yes. And this is where the psychological aspect completely eclipses the economic spreadsheet. In Kite Willett's video on divorce, she brings in Nick Haslam's 2016 psychological paper on concept creep.
Right. Concept creep.
Haslam, who is a psychologist from the University of Melbourne, he documented how clinical terms for severe harm have expanded outward and downward to cover everyday, ordinary friction.
So break down concept creep for me in this context. Like, what does that actually look like when two people are trying to navigate a marriage, particularly if they are already dealing with the pressures of a high-demand religion?
It looks like the pathologizing of normal human disagreement.
Okay.
Haslam identifies two directions this happens: vertical creep and horizontal creep.
Vertical and horizontal.
Right. Vertical creep is when a concept extends to milder behaviors. Horizontal creep is when a concept extends to entirely new kinds of behaviors.
Give me an example.
So instead of a spouse saying, "We disagree about how to budget our money," they say, "I am experiencing financial abuse."
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Or instead of saying, "I am exhausted by doing the laundry and I need you to step up," they say, "He is weaponizing his incompetence and gaslighting me about my reality."
Right. Using those really heavy clinical terms.
Exactly. And Adler's theory of teleology explains that human behavior is pulled by future goals, not just pushed by past causes. Reaching for this clinical language has a subconscious goal.
Which is what?
It is a safeguarding mechanism that protects a person's significance by elevating a preference or a negotiation into a clinical injury.
But why would someone subconsciously want to turn a manageable disagreement into a clinical injury? Like, that seems counterproductive if the goal is a happy marriage.
Because the goal has shifted. The goal has shifted from maintaining the marriage to securing the self.
Securing the self.
Yes. Using clinical language secures immediate validation from algorithms and peer groups who automatically side with a quote-unquote victim.
Especially online.
Oh, especially online. And most destructively, it eliminates the obligation to compromise. You compromise with a partner who has a different opinion, right?
Right.
You do not compromise with an abuser. You simply escape them, all while holding the moral high ground.
I see.
For someone exiting a high-demand faith like the LDS Church, where moral standing is everything, being the victim of harm is the only socially survivable way to leave a covenant.
Mm-hmm.
They aren't walking away from an economic bargain. They are using borrowed therapeutic language to execute a socially safe exit.
That is a fascinating interpretation of how language functions, though I would frame it differently.
How so? Are we sure this is concept creep? Are women finally acquiring the vocabulary to describe a real structural deficit that has been normalized for decades?
You think it's an accurate description?
I think we have to be incredibly careful not to dismiss valid systemic neglect just because the language sounds new or clinical to the mainstream.
Okay.
If we want to test whether this is just a psychological vocabulary issue or a harsh structural reality, let's look at the expectations placed on men and women.
Let's do it.
In Kite Willett's other video, The Responsibilities of Women That Men Never Receive, she cites Harvard research showing the impact of employment on marriage stability.
Yes, that's a tough study.
It is. The research shows that a man's involuntary job loss significantly increases the risk of his wife filing for divorce.
Right.
But a woman's job loss does not increase the risk of him filing. That data is certainly uncomfortable to confront, especially for those who want to believe modern marriage is completely egalitarian.
It is uncomfortable because it proves the economic bargain theory. It proves that expectations within the marriage are rigidly conditional for men based on their production, their financial output.
I see where you're going.
If a marriage was truly a covenantal, unconditional bond that was just being ruined by therapy speak, a job loss would be met with support.
Right.
Instead, when the man stops providing, the structural contract is breached and the marriage dissolves. It's not a psychological vocabulary issue happening in a vacuum. It is a harsh economic reality manifesting in the divorce courts.
So you're saying the provision is the only thing keeping them there?
Women aren't just deciding to weaponize terms to look good to their LDS bishops. They are reacting to a broken structural exchange where the man's primary value, his provision, has vanished.
I read that Harvard's study is proving the exact opposite of a rational structural exchange.
Really? How so?
It perfectly supports the reality of a highly asymmetric cultural script.
Okay.
The reason a man's job loss triggers divorce isn't just about the household cash flow. It is because our 40-year cultural project has explicitly defined male value by what he provides, performs, and manages.
Right, the classic gender roles.
But it's beyond that now. A modern husband is expected to provide financially, initiate repair after conflict, be a perfectly attuned safe space for her emotions, carry half the mental load, and maintain his physical fitness.
That's a long list.
It is. But there is absolutely no equivalent script for female obligation. When you ask the culture, what does a woman owe a man in a relationship, the response is dead silence. Or worse, hostility for even asking the question.
So you're suggesting that men are failing a test that women aren't even required to take?
Precisely. So when the man loses his job, he has failed his cultural script and he is discarded.
Wow.
But because women have no defined cultural script of obligation, like no reciprocal list of duties they must perform to maintain their value, they cannot fail in a way that licenses him to leave.
I see.
This dynamic leaves men feeling like functional utilities rather than covenantal partners. They are loved conditionally, based on output and performance, while being demanded to love unconditionally.
That's bleak.
It is. That isn't an equitable structural bargain. It is a psychological trap.
Okay. Well, as men are feeling like functional utilities, as you say, we should be seeing them walk away from the market entirely.
Which we are.
Exactly. And when we look at the downstream consequences of this crisis, the fallout is reshaping our entire demographic landscape.
It really is.
Max Fisher's video lays this out with chilling clarity, relying on Pew Research data. In 2020, Pew found that 67% of singles say dating is going poorly.
Two-thirds.
Yeah, two-thirds. By 2023, the survey data showed that only 36% of women are even interested in dating at all, compared to 52% of men.
Right.
We are looking at a mass exodus from the dating market, led heavily by women. And Fisher attributes this to the Zillow effect of infinite choice on apps.
The illusion that a better house or a better human is always just one swipe away.
Yes, but it changes the actual cognitive machinery of how we evaluate human beings.
How do you mean?
When our brains are presented with limitless options, the cognitive load is too heavy. We shift permanently into a filtering mode.
Ah, filtering mode.
We stop looking for reasons to connect, which, you know, requires vulnerability and patience. And we start looking purely for negative heuristics. Reasons to eliminate.
Right. Looking for red flags everywhere.
Exactly. It reduces human beings to a checklist of potential flaws. This creates what Derek Thompson called the antisocial century.
The antisocial century.
People are retreating to their screens, losing their social muscles, becoming more argumentative and less agreeable. So, put yourself in the shoes of a modern woman.
Okay.
She looks at a structural bargain that demands double the domestic labor, even if she out-earns her husband.
Right.
She scrolls through an app that has trained her brain to highlight every flaw in the male dating pool. Rationally, she chooses to retreat to the peace of her own home.
So it's just a logical withdrawal.
Exactly. The isolation is terrible, but within the current structure, it is a perfectly logical, economic, and social choice.
See, treating this isolation as a mere technological accident, or framing it as a rational choice driven by a bad user interface on an app, entirely misses the depth of the tragedy.
You don't think the apps are to blame?
They play a role, but you point to the Pew data showing women withdrawing, but let's look at the men.
Okay.
Pew Research's 2023 data also shows that 63% of men under 30 are single.
63%?
And despite the popular cultural narrative that paints these men as stunted adolescents living in basements, they are not broken. And they are not inherently afraid of commitment.
What are they doing then?
They are making a deeply rational choice after watching the machinery of modern divorce operate on their fathers, their brothers, and their friends.
So you argue they are preemptively boycotting the institution before they can be penalized by it?
They are observing the landscape and deciding the risk is unmanageable. They see the exact dynamic highlighted by the University of Georgia study on marital quality, which found that spoken gratitude is the highest predictor of relationship success.
Spoken gratitude?
Yes. Yet they look at modern dating and marriage and see a complete lack of spoken gratitude. They see a culture of entitlement replacing covenant.
Right.
They see women demanding that men meet an impossible, ever-expanding list of obligations: financial, emotional, domestic, while refusing to articulate what they bring to the table other than their mere presence.
It feels very one-sided to them.
Exactly.
The men are looking at the 69% divorce asymmetry. They are watching the weaponized concept creep turn normal flaws into clinical abuse, and they are deciding the juice isn't worth the squeeze.
And the stakes of this mutual withdrawal are incredibly high, which, you know, brings us back to the specific premise we opened with, the Latter-day Saint and strict conservative faith experience.
Right, where the stakes are the highest.
When the traditional framework of marriage breaks down for someone who has banked their entire existence on it, the collateral damage is immense.
It's total devastation.
If you are listening to this and you've recently gone through a faith-based divorce, you know that the loss isn't just a change in living arrangements.
The loss is catastrophic. In Kite Willett's video, Divorce, Why the System is Failing Men, she brings up the foundational research by Robert Madrow from 1987, which has been confirmed again by Pew in 2025.
Right.
Men in heterosexual marriages overwhelmingly rely on their wives as their primary and often only source of emotional intimacy.
They don't have the networks.
Exactly. Women generally cultivate broad support networks, friends, mothers, extended family, community groups. When a marriage ends, a woman usually walks into a safety net of emotional support. A man walks out into an empty room.
He loses his entire emotional infrastructure in a single blow, overnight.
And the statistical fallout of that isolation is horrifying. Willett points out that divorced men have nearly 3 times the suicide risk of married men.
3 times.
Separated men, those in the acute phase of the breakup, are at nearly 5 times the risk.
Wow.
Within 1 year of divorce, a man is roughly 6 times more likely to develop an alcohol use disorder. 20% of male suicides in this country are tied directly to the breakdown of an intimate relationship.
Those numbers are just, they're staggering.
Now compound that with a man coming out of a strict faith background, like the LDS Church. He isn't just losing his wife, his daily access to his children, and his only confidant.
Right, it goes so much deeper.
He is losing his eternal family, his standing in his ward, his perceived righteousness, and his theological future. He becomes a cautionary tale in his own community. It is total social and spiritual exile.
Looking at those outcomes, I think this is a point of profound convergence for our discussion.
Absolutely.
Regardless of whether we view the root cause of this crisis as structural or psychological, we both have to acknowledge that the traditional framework of dating and marriage has collapsed.
It's undeniable.
And this collapse has left midlife singles, especially those disentangling from strict religious backgrounds where marriage was the ultimate and only acceptable marker of identity, in an unprecedented state of grief and crisis.
It is a quiet demographic emergency.
It really is.
You have an entire cohort of people who were promised that if they followed the rules, maintained their purity, and honored the covenant, they would be rewarded with lifelong companionship and spiritual exaltation.
Right. That was the deal.
Now they are in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. Their marriages have exploded or never materialized in the first place, and they are grappling with a terrifying, silent void.
Yet our divergence remains firmly on the mechanism of the collapse.
Yes, it does.
I maintain that this collapse, while incredibly painful and statistically devastating, is primarily a necessary structural correction.
A correction?
Yes. The economic and labor bargain of traditional marriage was fundamentally unbalanced. Women were carrying an unsustainable load, doing double the domestic work even when providing the financial security.
But
the current crisis is the messy, destructive process of the market demanding a new, equitable bargain. One that doesn't require a woman to take on a second shift of uncompensated labor just for the privilege of a wedding ring and social acceptance.
And I maintain that viewing this through a purely economic lens obscures a profound cultural and psychological tragedy.
Well?
The collapse is being driven by an asymmetric vocabulary of harm, concept creep, that has replaced grace, gratitude, and covenant with a hostile contractual evaluation.
Right.
We have built a culture that tells men they owe everything and tells women they are owed everything, offering them moral cover to leave when their partners inevitably fall short of perfection. No relationship structure can survive with all the load-bearing weight and accountability placed entirely on one side.
It reflects the deep complexity of reclaiming desire and authentic connection in 2026. For our listeners, especially those navigating the debris of a faith-based divorce, or the isolation of midlife singlehood, these videos offer profound frameworks for understanding your own relational history.
They really do.
They force you to look at the mechanics of why your life looks the way it does.
I highly encourage anyone wrestling with these issues to look closer at their own experiences through these dual lenses. Are you experiencing the genuine exhaustion of a structural imbalance where your labor is being exploited?
Right.
Or are you caught in the subtle defensive machinery of concept creep, pushing away a good partner because an algorithm told you ordinary friction is toxic? Have you lost the ability to speak gratitude, or have you been crushed by a partner who treated you as a functional utility rather than a human being?
The answers are rarely simple, and they require a brutal honesty about both our structural reality and our psychological defenses.
Very true.
Stepping into the world of modern relationship dynamics is stepping out of a clean, binary world and into diagnostic muddy waters. The covenant has shattered, the markers are gone, and finding your way back to authentic connection requires navigating that murkiness without a chaperone. We leave the final judgment to you, the listener, to determine which framework best explains the landscape you find yourself in.
Thank you for navigating it with us.
We'll see you next time.